so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with two outstanding gentlemen, Mervyn King and John Kay, both of whom have been integral to the conversations, the debates, and the explorations at the Institute for New Economic Thinking from its very beginning. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me here today. The book that they have created on the theme Radical Uncertainty is absolutely at the core or at the foundation of the things that iNet was founded to explore. Many know that George Soros wrote a book that was called The Alchemy of Finance, and his concerns about the way in which risk and uncertainty were characterized in finance was explored somewhat there. I myself became an economist when a gentleman named Charles Kindleberger was working on a book at MIT called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, which didn't look much like equilibrium economics. But gentlemen, let's focus on your thoughts and why, I guess I'm curious, why were you inspired at this point in time, which I presume predated the pandemic, but at this point in time, why did you rise to the challenge and choose this project?
Well, for me, it was the financial crisis. I was at the Bank of England. We had to try and work out what was going on. And it became very clear extremely quickly that the conventional models that people used either to make forecasts or to analyze analytically monetary policy were not very helpful at all. And it was extremely difficult to get people to change their mindset and to focus on what was going on here, a question that we pose right through the book. And so I went back and tried to read what people had written during the 1930s. And what became very clear in those debates was that it was the same sort of situation. There was a standard model that people had used, which they found very hard to give up. And so it was extremely difficult for them to contemplate the idea that there could be persistent unemployment or low demand for a long period of time. It was really a question of getting rid of market imperfections and getting back to equilibrium rather quickly. And the names that started, it was very clear that Keynes, on writing this, not just in his general theory, but in the articles he wrote around it, genuinely believed that uncertainty, in the way that he formulated it, we call it radical uncertainty, was at the heart of the problem of understanding why an economy did not quickly get back to equilibrium. And I was very struck that modern economists had rather pushed that side of Keynes out of the picture and instead focused on the importance of nominal rigidities and the importance of using fiscal policy when there was a downturn. And neither of these seemed to me to be sufficiently general or plausible to explain the extraordinary events that we were seeing. Well, time moved on a little, and I was still at the bank. And just before I left, we had a workshop, and John came to it. And John and I had written a book together over 40 years ago now on the British tax system. And we found that from our different perspectives, we had both come to the view that it was very hard to understand what was going on in the economy, whether you think of that as macroeconomic events or whether you think of it as microeconomic events, without taking seriously the idea of radical uncertainty. And so we decided to collaborate, and this book is a result.
And my...
Well, John, you wrote a book I remember you profiled with Inet. Was it Obliquity?
Yeah.
Was the title. And I remember when I saw the two of you were co-authors, I had memories of how curious I was about that book. But how do you see the same thing or address the question?
Which I published in 2010 was a step on an intellectual journey, which really began in the 90s when I started getting engaged with business, both as consultant and as board director. And as academic economist, I learned and taught to see the world in terms of optimization. And I realized that these business people weren't actually maximizing profits or shareholder value. And like a good economist, I stood back and asked, so if they're not maximizing that, what are they maximizing? Then I came to realize that actually they and people generally in life aren't maximizing anything. People are trying to look for solutions to complicated problems that are good enough. And that's a quite different way of thinking. And when you start thinking in these terms, I believe you think very differently about business, about finance, particularly about finance, and about public policy. And I was articulating some of these ideas in the workshop that Mervyn was describing and in some conversations that he and I had thereafter. And we realized that from very different places, very different angles, we'd come to rather similar conclusions about the inadequacies of conventional economic frameworks for dealing with these kind of problems.
Well, Mervyn, I know you mentioned a little bit related to Keynes, but what you might call the intellectual underpinnings are often, of radical uncertainty, are often explored. And the name Frank Knight also comes onto the stage very quickly. How do you, I guess, tell the tale of how this notion of radical uncertainty came to the surface? And were there differences in perspective between Knight on one hand and Keynes on the other?
Well, they were very different people. They were different economists. They were studying different problems. But I think they both felt that the idea that you could capture uncertainty in terms of a view that said we know all the possible things that could occur in the world and we can attach probabilities to them, which leads directly through various axioms to the view that people will optimize and they will maximize, whether you call it their expected utility or some other phrase like that. This optimizing view comes directly out of a fundamental assumption that we do know the various events that will occur and we can attach probabilities to them. And Frank Knight argued that this was incompatible with the idea of entrepreneurship, where people were creating something that other people didn't know could be done or existed. And Keynes was trying to understand something very different, which was why it was that people might refuse to spend a great deal, even when encouraged to do so with lower interest rates, because their expectations about the future had become more pessimistic. And I think fully to understand all this, you really needed to have jumped further than Keynes was able to do, because it was the work of people like Arrow and De Broglie in the early 50s who told economists that one way of trying to think about uncertainty is to imagine all the various states of the world that could occur and the various commodities that you could buy and sell in those different states of the world. And Arrow and De Broglie's point was to say, you need to have markets in all these different future contingent commodities in order to argue that a competitive economy is likely to be efficient. And since these markets plainly do not exist, the presumption is that it's unlikely that markets are likely to be efficient. That doesn't mean to say the state can easily do better, but it does mean that we don't start with a presumption of an efficient outcome. And that was a point that was argued clearly in the 50s, but it wasn't really available. It wasn't thought through and discussed in the same way in the 1930s. And Keynes actually had rather given in himself to the view that you could have assigned probabilities to various events. His colleague in Cambridge, Frank Ramsey, was the person who proposed the idea that you could assume that people had subjective probabilities defined over all possible future events. Now, John and I strongly disagree with this. And what's fascinating is that the literature and economics from then on, and I'll ask John to pick up the story after Keynes as we go into the post-war period, is that it's obvious in a way that people do not have probabilities defined over all these possible future events. We don't know what all the events are going to be, and we certainly wouldn't be prepared to take bets on them. And Frank Ramsey's proposition was that you could deduce or infer these probabilities from the odds at which people would be prepared to bet on future outcomes. But this is something which is blatantly false. People do not bet on everything. In fact, if they're wise, they choose not to bet on a large number of things, even if they were offered the chance to bet, because they are concerned that they don't really understand it, and the people offering the bets probably understand more. So there's no basis on which you can start by assuming that these subjective probabilities exist. And yet, if you look at modern literature, the assumption from line one of the paper is that these subjective probabilities exist. And then you wheel out the axioms of optimizing behavior, and you infer from that that it's sensible to assume that everyone maximizes expected utility. You have to be an economist to believe that. Nobody else would be persuaded that it makes a great deal of sense. But perhaps John could pick up the story from the period when Keynes got very frustrated he was persuaded by Frank Ramsey that subjective probabilities existed. And then in the general theory, he reverts back to his previous views, which were that they don't exist, and that the really important kind of uncertainty is what we call radical uncertainty, namely where you have no idea what could happen in future. And you certainly, even if you can define future events, you can't attach probabilities to them. John?
You know, there's an intriguing transatlantic divide on this, Rob. You talked about Knightian uncertainty. In England, the debate was within Cambridge University, Cambridge, and it was between Keynes on the one hand and Frank Ramsey on the other. In the United States, the debate was at Chicago, and it was between Knight on the one hand and then Friedman and Savage on the other side of the argument, which is possibly why we from Britain tend to think of it as a Keynesian issue and Americans as a Knightian issue. Ramsey, of course, didn't pursue the argument very far because he died prematurely at the age of 26. He's an astonishing polymath, and who knows what he might have produced if he had lived. But then, in the post-war era, as Mervyn has said, the debate was carried on almost entirely on the American side of the Atlantic. And it was developed particularly first by von Neumann and Morgenstern, who developed axiomatic approaches to decision-making, and then particularly by Friedman and Savage, who developed this axiomatic approach to behavior under uncertainty. And that was put forward in a seminal article by Friedman and Savage in 1948 and taken up by in Savage's famous Foundations of Statistics 5 years or so later. And this view that you can attach probabilities to every possible outcome became completely dominant and has characterized finance theory and rational expectations, macroeconomics, ever since. But you know, the best response to that argument I think I've ever seen comes from an improbable source. It's Marlon Brando as Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls. And Skye says, my father once gave me this bit of advice. And it was, one day someone will show you an unopened pack of cards and tell you that the jack will jump out of the pack and pour cider in your ear. And someone will offer to invite you to take a bet on that. And Brando says, son, do not take that bet, because as sure as you do, you will end up with an ear full of cider. And the point being made there, of course, is that in a world in which information is imperfect and is not uniformly distributed, it is very foolish to bet on most things, because on many things, on most things, other people will actually have better information than you do, which is why they're willing to take the bet. And I think that particular quote probably ought to be on the desk of every trader in Wall Street and the City of London.
I would agree.
Of course, the other fascinating aspect of all this is that in many ways, the most complete academic denunciation of this view that you can attach probabilities to all events and that people will therefore maximize expected utility came from Savage himself, because in his book, he points out that the assumptions you have to make in order to draw that conclusion that this is how people will behave apply only to what he described as a small world in which very strong assumptions hold. And for most aspects of human life, he said it would be ridiculous. It was his own word, ridiculous, to assume that you could make these judgments and believe in these axioms as a description of behavior. And he wanted to develop the logical implications of the small world. But what happened was that actually even he himself, but certainly his followers, decided that they wanted to claim that these applied to the large world. And that's where the mistake was made. And people just ignored it and forgot it in the rush to say, we have a tremendous tool here, maximizing expected utility. Let's apply it to lots of practical situations.
You know, there's a funny aspect again for the transatlantic divide on this, because the beginnings of behavioral economics really go back to a dinner party in Paris in 1952. And it was a very distinguished personnel at the dinner party. There were Friedman and Savage, and there were Maurice Allais, the Frenchman who won a Nobel Prize, and Paul Samuelson was there also. So there were four Nobel Prize winners around the table, and Bruno Di Finetti, who was a rather strange Italian who wrote some very interesting material on all of this. And what Allais did was he managed to present the people at the dinner party with a series of bets and was able to show them that they behaved inconsistently in terms of the underlying axioms in their choices of these bets. And Allais was quite clear, and the people at the dinner party were quite clear, that what Allais was doing was not showing that these people were stupid. They were very far from stupid. It was about the most intelligent grouping of people, of economists, you could have in a room at one time. What Allais was doing was critiquing this idea of rationality in terms of the dominant axioms of behavior under uncertainty. Now, Savage then went back to the United States and decided actually that he'd been wrong at the dinner party. He hadn't revealed his preferences correctly, and went on, as it were, regardless from there. But it was still true for some time that behavioral economics was regarded as a critique of the underlying models, not as a critique of people for failing to behave in accordance with these models. And that was the way in which Daniel Ellsberg, who became more famous for leaking the Pentagon Papers than for his contributions to economics, but he led an American critique of this kind of thinking in the early 60s. But in the 70s, when behavioral economics was taken up by Kahneman and Tversky, and the people who followed them, it was entirely clear that if people didn't behave in accordance with the models of rationality, that was a criticism of them. They were irrational, they were making mistakes, and increasingly it was argued they ought to be corrected or nudged into making more appropriate decisions. But actually we think the Allais critique in this sense was right, that what we should be doing is rethinking our assumption that these axioms represent rationality rather than criticizing behavior. It's a general fault of economists. You know this all too well in INET, that if the model doesn't describe the world, that's the fault of the world rather than a fault of the model.
Yeah. One of my favorite teachers was my fishing buddy at Princeton, Peter Kennan, a famous international economist. And he used to say, economists have a credo, have model, looking for problem to apply it to.
And that's one of the things we talk about a bit in the book, which is that, you know, if you have a problem with your kitchen and you want a plumber to come round, you want a plumber to look at the kitchen first and say, you know, what's going on here? What's the problem? And then to ask the question, what's the tool or model to deal with it? What you don't want is an economist who turns up with a model and says, well, I've got a model that can solve this problem. Let's try and turn your problem into one that this tool can solve. And that is I think, one of the problems, that somehow method has become more important than substance. We talk in the book a lot about models, and we say that models are very important. They can produce extremely valuable and significant insights into what's going on in the world. But it's not the model or the method that we should be focusing on primarily. We should choose the method and the model to throw light on the particular problem that we've got. And that is too often forgotten.
You know, there's this mantra amongst economists, it takes a model to beat a model. But actually, it doesn't take a model to beat a model. It takes observation of the world to beat a model. And that's the way we ought to think about it.
Yeah, I guess the whole notion of the defense of intellectual property rights plays a refractory influence here. When a scholar becomes famous for creating a model and seeks to broaden the extent to which it is relevant, they often run beyond that place where it is illuminating. And while defending what you might call the power of what they've created, they begin to mislead rather than illuminate.
I think that's true, but I mean, it's not true of everyone. If you think about, you know, George Akerlof, Michael Spence, Joe Stiglitz, Economics of Information, they produced incredibly powerful insights into how to think about the world. But they didn't sort of insist that every problem in economics had to be examined through the same model. But I think in macroeconomics, there is a tendency for people to say, this is the model we must use. And I think it's proved very damaging in the study of monetary policy in the last decade, because there is one model which abstracts from many, many important things. The model was very useful in understanding certain issues about the importance of time and consistency, about independence of central banks, etc. But if you want to know what's been happening in the world in the last decade, you should look at the world and not just start with a model where there's only essentially one relative price in it, the interest rate.
Well, Mervyn, you were a central bank governor, and there's been a very long-term debate going back to when I was educated in the early 80s about rules versus discretion. And people who were suspicious of government discretion often thought, well, we have to fasten things down to rules. One of the gentlemen I worked for as a research assistant for a couple of years, John Taylor, tried to build a framework around this. But in the context of radical uncertainty, when we don't know what the model is or the model is evolving, when a group of trusted public officials make an adjustment, you can draw the inference that they're deviating from the rule, or you can draw the inference that the model has evolved and they're following observations before the rest of us have seen the change in structure. So I find the rules versus discretion dichotomy much less helpful than was advertised in the years of my education.
I think that's true. And I think that the advent of inflation targeting was actually, in its early years, a way of trying to say, what we want to do is to force central bankers to explain what they're doing in terms of a compelling narrative. And sometimes they would say, we haven't changed our view of how the world works, but we've been given a different mandate or we have a different objective. On other occasions, they'll say, no, the objective is exactly the same as it was last year, but we've changed our view about how the economy works. And the way to build credibility in that environment was to ensure that the central bank had to explain in words that other economists and business people could critique and analyze, and force them to say why it was that they took the decisions they did. That was the essence of it. It wasn't a mechanical response, because the view you had of the economy was bound to change over time as you learned about what was going on. And one of the odd things is that the model that people inferred was behind this approach has become more and more dominant, so much so that it now, I think, contradicts the original philosophy, in that what we now do is to say that central banks are assumed to know sufficiently about the future to predict where interest rates will go and therefore engage in forward guidance. I think the original idea was that we didn't know where we would be putting interest rates 6 months from now because we didn't know where the economy would be. But what we could do was to try to behave in a way that didn't change a great deal over time, but we would explain what we had learned about the economy and how the economy had developed. But we didn't pretend to be able to predict where the economy would go. And I think that the use of this one standard model has made people in central banks overly optimistic about their ability to predict the future, and has led to a view that, you know, central banks are the only game in town, that if the economy is growing more slowly than desired, the answer has to be a monetary policy response. This is a very bizarre view, because if you go back to the models that people were thinking of in the 1960s, there are all kinds of reasons why an economy might be growing below the rate which we could hope it might attain. Some of them have to do with the sort of factors that monetary policy can respond to, but others have very different sources. They're more structural in nature, or then maybe the economy's got stuck in a disequilibrium. But the idea that there's just one model and therefore one policy instrument that we tackle every problem with is I think an intellectual weakness, and it just doesn't make any sense, really.
You know, there's a common underlying problem to all these phases of policy, which is believing that we know more about the world than we actually do or could. And the reason we had this rules versus discretion debate was that back in the 60s through to the 70s, people believed that in macro policy, they could fine-tune in taxation policies, fiscal policies, and monetary policies to keep the economy on a smooth course. And they discovered in the 70s, in the late 60s, that that simply wasn't true. You didn't have the kind of knowledge to do that. But then we went into a different, as it were, arrogance of knowledge phase, in which we believed that we knew so much about the model, that, and indeed that economic agents knew so much about the model, that the main thing to do was to give them the kind of uncertainty which came from following rules and eliminating discretion. But we never, as Mervyn has been explaining, had enough knowledge of the model to be able to do that.
There's a rather strange dilemma when you are cast as an expert in the world. At times of great uncertainty, and I'm speaking, as you do, radical uncertainty of not knowing, it is often the case that a person who pretends to know more than they do actually, for a time, helps those seeking their guidance to feel better. It alleviates anxiety until the false, what you might call confidence that they espoused, is unmasked. But I've seen in my own training, in my own experience, that often the person who's boldest in declaration of knowing seems to prevail in economic debates for a time. And so I guess what I'm saying is, at some level, the anxiousness of the population or the investor or whoever in those periods of uncertainty is complicit in the ritual that produces that pretense of knowledge and that arrogance.
Yes, we have this paradox in economics that people are very skeptical of economic forecasting and yet feel desperately in need of it. Yeah. And I've never known quite how to respond to these things. And someone asks me at a dinner party, so you're an economist, what do you think is going to happen? It's a question that troubled me for a long time, mm-hmm. until I discovered the best way to answer it is to say, so what do you think is going to happen, and let them talk.
Mm-hmm.
But Rob, I think this goes to the heart of what is good leadership. And I think good leadership is where the leaders do not delegate responsibility for decisions to experts and rely on them, but they probe and challenge the views of experts, and they feel it's their job then to communicate to the wider public the uncertainty that is really out there. And to be honest and say, look, none of us really know the future, but given what we know today, we think this is probably the best course, but we mm-hmm. are going to study this and challenge. And if we have to change course, we will do so without hesitation. And I think that the COVID-19 crisis is a very good example of many of the things we talk about in the book. It's a classic example of radical uncertainty. We knew there were pandemics, but no one could possibly have attached a probability to the statement a year ago, for example, well, what's the probability that there'll be a virus emanating from Wuhan in China in December 2019? It would have been a meaningless question to ask. But we knew that pandemics were likely. When it hit, the one thing we knew was, we knew something about the qualitative nature of epidemics. They're captured in the mathematical models of epidemics. But we did not know very much about the crucial parameters that position that precise chart. So the ability to make quantitative predictions about the path of the epidemic and about how that would respond to various restrictions the government could impose, and about how what would happen if you relax those restrictions. We knew very little about that. And I think that if governments had been more open and honest about that, they wouldn't have hit many of the difficulties they have, in which they've been jumping around, changing policy. And it's not been a terribly happy episode anywhere. And we now see further outbreaks coming, springing up. That was something that was always possible. And we still get the mantra, you know, suppress, suppress, suppress. But no one's actually explained how you can ever suppress it to zero until you get a vaccine. And even that will require many years of vaccination before it finally disappears. There's been a lack of sort of honesty and openness about the uncertainty. And as a result, I think the population feels that they're being left out. Instead of being involved in a decision-making process where their leaders have said to them, we don't know enough to make clear and obvious decisions. We're going to make mistakes here. This is trial and error, and we want to involve you in it. They've been lectured at, and they've been told that X was the right policy. The next week, Y was the right policy. The week after, Z was the right policy. You lose credibility in this way. And I've seen that in monetary policy, and I think we've seen it recently in the area of dealing with COVID-19, that if you adopt this pretense of knowledge, either on your own part or by relying on experts, you come a cropper and you lose credibility. And that is bad for our system of governance.
You are, Mervyn, you are speaking right to the heart of the formation of INET. I worked very closely. I used to be the chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee in the United States during the time of the 87 stock market crash and the savings and loan bailout. Robert Duggar worked closely with me. He was my predecessor on the Senate side and also before that chief economist on the House side banking committee. When the TARP legislation, the Lehman crisis, was unfolding, all of the alumni of those committees went down to help Senator Dodd and Congressman Frank and their staff, some of whom were our former colleagues. And during that time, as the TARP legislation was being pulled together and envisioned, I consulted closely with George Soros, and at times we prepared op-eds together, which he had the final draft and released under his name, about what was unfolding. When the TARP legislation passed, and some of the what you might call the distributional questions were brought to the surface, it would be controversial. George and Rob Duggar and I had a lunch, and George said, we have to found something, which is now called INET, because I lived as a child in Hungary when the Nazi invasion tore apart the country of my early teen years and led to a war. And in my own study, it was the financial crisis of Austria and Germany. This is Mr. Soros talking, was the critical threshold where credibility and trust and faith in systems and governance disintegrated. There had been hyperinflation, but he viewed that as the threshold point. And he said that his fear was that after all of the financial deregulation, and we should come back to that in light of your model, but the pretense of knowing or that value at risk measures that what they called rocket scientists, quantitative financiers could present to the management so that everybody could be comfortable all night long, that it was all in hand and all understood, until obviously it wasn't as that crisis unfolded. But that and then the structure of the bailout and the ensuing legislation, I guess I would say in my conversations in the years since with George Soros, it felt like what was originally a loss of credibility regarding financial regulation started to spread into questions related to inequality, social sustainability, the management of globalization, and now climate, and now the pandemic. It's as if a disease of loss of faith and trust in expertise and administration was unleashed by the financial crisis and has continued to propagate. And I know in your work, you're seeing the world through a very different lens now than those models and optimization. And I guess that what you might call false confidence in financial modeling was the one that shook me, because I had worked with Soros' hedge fund after being a financial regulator, and it just wasn't the world I lived in. But I'm asking both of you now, how, in light of what you're expressing and uncovering and sharing with us, how should we change the nature of financial regulation and governance and administration more broadly? You referred to it a little bit, Mervyn, in the context of monetary policy, but this seems to be a very fundamental change in vision of a process. And if I guess I'm asking, if we do it right amidst this uncertainty, can we regain that trust and faith so the value added that experts and public officials, career civil servants can provide becomes respected once again?
Let me start with one brief point and then ask John to expand on it. The big mistake that I saw in the construction of financial regulation was the view that, well, obviously last time it didn't work very well, so let's have a new Basel process. We had Basel III and it's been amended since. But this time we'll get it right. And we have an ever more complicated system, many more risk weights. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see what went wrong last time. And because of that, we know that we can now design a very good system. And it's again the pretense of knowledge. It's the view that this complex system of detailed regulations, which may or may not be, if it had been in place, appropriate to deal with the last crisis, is actually going to help when you come to the different circumstances of the next crisis. And I think that this is deep down what's been going on. And John talked about his own intellectual journey. And I'll mention one point of mine. When I went to be a student at Cambridge, I went because I was excited about the possibility of computer modeling of an economy. And we learned about the Great Depression. And you could see that the people who were responsible for taking the decisions then, they looked old-fashioned. They had hats and whiskers. And, you know, they were obviously fuddy-duddies. And they made mistakes. And so as a discipline, economics wrote many books about the mistakes that were made in the Great Depression. Didn't really do it properly from analyzing, what was going on each day as we went through it. It was easy to, with the benefit of hindsight, to identify mistakes. But the assumption that we wouldn't make similar mistakes in the future was based on the idea that we have proper mathematical models, we knew the models, we knew what was going on, we wouldn't make the same mistakes. The financial crisis comes along, the biggest banking financial crisis in human history. What went wrong? Well, it was again the pretense of knowledge in part, not completely, but in part. And the belief that somehow we were superior to people in the past. I remember giving a speech at Mansion House before the crisis hit in middle of 2007. And I talked about excess leverage. And I said, and I finished that part of the speech by saying, why do we think we are wiser than the financiers of the past? And there was a section of the audience that booed when I made that remark, because we obviously were superior to the financiers of the past and we wouldn't see the same problems happening again. Well, within 2 years they had. And it's this great difficulty of persuading people that their views as experts may be very valuable, but nevertheless, it doesn't mean to say that they can foresee the future. And we need therefore to put much greater weight on things like resilience, than pretend that we can optimize and find the perfect system or weights for capital regulation, for example. But John, you've also got views on this.
I mean, we haven't rethought regulation in any kind of fundamental way. As Mervyn is describing, the take on what happened in 2008 seems to be that broadly the value at risk type of modeling structure was roughly the right thing to do. It's just we didn't get the parameters quite right. So if we tweak them going forward, we will avoid problems. And at best, we might avoid that particular problem. But we need to understand, I think, that regulation has been as much part of the problem as it is part of the solution. That the laying down of risk weights, capital requirements of various kinds, and capital requirements that differed across different kinds of instruments and indeed different kinds of institutions, that was actually the source of much of the complexity that blew up in 2008. And the attempt to lay down very detailed regulation in finance or indeed in any other area of business regulation tends to lead to people operating within the parameters of that regulation in ways that may actually not, and in this case conspicuously didn't, achieve the objectives which the regulators and the regulation had in mind. What we need to do, as Mervyn was saying, is actually go back to some of the wisdom of the financiers of the past. They avoided these kind of crises for quite some time, not because they had better models, but by virtue of two things. One was structural restrictions, the siloing of different activities into different institutions, which prevented the kind of contagion which was such a problem in 2008. And actually, the accumulated wisdom and judgment of people who had been around for a long time and had seen not exactly these things happen before, but at any rate had had understood that many things of a kind which they couldn't anticipate had happened before. They didn't believe they knew the model, or that even worse, they didn't believe that they had very smart risk management professionals who knew the model, which is what one was told again and again in the years before 2008.
Do you feel that, what you might call, when one embraces the credibility of humility about what we don't know, and ask that we all, what you might call, bear the weight of uncertainty together, that we can regain trust? And the other question I want to ask is, what is the role of narrative rather than model in the unfolding and description? Mervyn, you spoke about that a process with monetary policy of, as things unfolded, you kept telling people, evolving what you thought the best thing to do was, but you didn't pretend you could see the future. Is that is that more of a narrative type approach than a what you might call plug in and play the model approach?
No, it certainly is. And I'll give you one example, which was my experience on the Monetary Policy Committee after the Bank of England was made independent. And initially, there was some skepticism that what people described as a bunch of academics could ever do anything that was worthwhile. People complained that we started to disagree with each other and so on. But then it settled down. And I remember going out and speaking in different regions of the UK, and invariably people would come up and the business people would say, you know, I'm really pleased that the Monetary Policy Committee is taking the decision on interest rates. And I'd say, well, I'm glad to hear that. And then they'd say typically, well, you know, I didn't agree with your last decision, but I'm very glad that the way it's being reached is through your process. And what they meant by that was that, and they would go on to say that, you know, all the arguments that I would have put forward were actually discussed at your meeting. And I can see that from the description in the minutes. And there were two things that were important about it. One was that it wasn't the decision of one individual. It was the decision of a group of people. We took the decision by majority vote. And that way we did manage to elicit a lot of different views and narratives about the economy, which could be contrasted and compared. And secondly, that we came out with a narrative. We didn't publish a model. We came out with a narrative which would explain why we thought the risks were to inflation, for example, were more on the upside than the downside. It was a story that we were telling, and the story evolved. And the way we gained credibility and trust, which we did, I think, very effectively, was to be prepared to have that narrative critiqued by other people. But we were presented in a way where people over time said, well, you know, these people don't pretend to know what's going to happen in the future, but they have a very intelligent view of what's going on in the economy. No one's going to find it easy to take these decisions, but this is as good as it's going to get. So we like this method of taking decisions, and that's why it's survived, and no one's really threatened or challenged it. And I think that's the important point, which is to be willing to be open, to be as smart as you can in presenting a narrative. You get good people on it. There's no, you won't get convincing, credible narratives by having third-rate people involved. You've got to have good people involved, but you also have to be willing to demonstrate that reasonable people can disagree because the future is unknowable. And that way people recognize that this is similar to the decisions they make in their own businesses or indeed in their own personal lives. What is very odd about a political process that certainly we've got into in the United Kingdom and seems now to be very much set in the United States is a view that whenever there's a problem, the government, the presiding party comes out saying solution A is obviously the only one that makes any sense. The opposition there says, no, A is a disaster, B is the only one that makes any sense. Even though behind closed doors, they have been struggling themselves and recognize that A and B are difficult to choose between. But having chosen one of them, they then feel they have to go out and pretend that it was the only possible choice that any sensible person could make. And that's how you lose credibility.
Is what I would call the role of punctuality in admitting when you were wrong, or not even wrong, that you have discovered that the path must change. Is that part of the process of gaining trust and understanding that you how would I say, don't hide behind a change in circumstance, but acknowledge it, even if it surprises you or contradicts what you previously believed?
I think it is, Rob. And I think it's important you have that process of acknowledging uncertainty and inviting debate about it before you arrive at a conclusion, as well as in the period subsequent to it. We talk a lot about the so-called wisdom of crowds, but there's a mistake that thinks the wisdom of crowds is the average opinion of the crowd. That's a mistake people make a lot in using this kind of term in relation to financial markets. But actually, the wisdom of crowds is the aggregate of information, not the average of information. You don't fly a plane by asking the passengers what they think. You fly a plane by having trained pilots and navigators and so on who have expertise in that particular area. And the business of flying a plane from A to B is an immensely complicated exercise that involves the contributions of many different people. Building a modern airliner is something that no individual knows how to do, but 1,000 people working together do know how to do. And that's the nature of our modern life. And it's a nature which we've almost forgotten in a lot of analysis which polarizes agency in our economy between individuals and the state. It is actually people working together in nested groups who actually achieve all the amazing things that our economy has made possible.
You talked, Mervyn, about the pandemic as an example of this. As you together put your vision or your sensibilities as they crystallize, if you were appointed to what you might call the Reform of Governance Committee for Planet Earth, what are the domains that you think are most out of balance at this juncture? Where are the places that this humility and this acceptance of uncertainty are most germane? And where are the places that are what you might call more ergodically stable, where traditional practice is less dangerous or damaging?
Well, I think the two best examples that we've seen in recent years have been the financial crisis and now the COVID-19 pandemic, in which we trusted that the precise mechanisms that we'd developed based on past information would cope with a new crisis. And that was a mistake. We learnt from the financial crisis that we had not focused enough on the resilience and robustness of the financial system. We'd assumed that people trying to run as lean an operation and as profitable an operation as possible would lead to outcomes that for the system as a whole would avoid collapse. And that turned out to be false. And equally with COVID-19, we did not put enough weight on the resilience of our health system or our ability to respond to a pandemic. So a good example, I think, would be that last year, the US and the UK were rated internationally as being the two best countries prepared for a pandemic. Well, in the event, I don't think it's easy to square that with the outcomes. The UK and the US had plenty of committees, procedures on paper, but what they didn't have was a structure that asked the right questions when a new pandemic came along. So that in the UK, many of the assumptions that were made about how to respond were based on the implicit assumption that a new virus would be like the flu virus. And this turned out to be rather different. And that, so that people didn't immediately take the opportunity to say, well, what can we do to find out more about this virus before we make judgments as to how we should respond? So I think that focusing on resilience and robustness is going to be very important. I think it's in many ways, of course, part of the argument for worrying about climate change and thinking about what we should do about it. But equally, that debate really has to take on board that climate change is not the only way in which the world may come to an end. There are many other ways, and some of them could happen far sooner, of which a pandemic is just one example. So I think it's getting governments to understand that it isn't just a question, as John said just now, of thinking of society as the state and millions of individual agents taking their own maximizing decisions, or even in behavioral economics terms of being subject to lots of biases where you have to nudge them in certain directions. It's a cooperative venture in which we need to have a dialogue which recognizes the uncertainty about many of the big questions we face and come up with ways of intelligently responding to it, and recognizing that none of us is ever going to be in a position to claim that a particular course of action is the optimal response.
Yeah. I mean, Mervyn has used two words which are absolutely key in our view to the way we think about radical uncertainty, which are robustness and resilience. We do not know what is going to happen, and therefore we need to make sure that our strategies, our approaches, what we call our reference narratives, are robust and resilient. And as you know, Rob, from your background in engineering, when you talk about robustness and resilience of complex systems with engineers, they will emphasize modularity and redundancy. Modularity meaning that part of a system can fail without it leading to collapse of the total. And redundancy, meaning you don't run things at the minimum that you think you can get away with. Now, that's key to understanding both the financial crisis and the failures in relation to the pandemic, because in both cases, we'd regarded modularity and redundancy as indicators of inefficiency and tried to eliminate them. And we paid the price when these crises proved as devastating as they were. We can also observe that of the major economies of the world, the one which has dealt with the pandemic best is Germany. And what characterizes the German approach is it's massively decentralized in contrast to the UK. But that decentralization is in a coherent overall framework in contrast to the United States. And I hope when we think about the lessons of the pandemic in the next year or two, we will learn the lesson that tells us.
Yeah, John, you remind me, a few years back, I spent a lot of time in China. There had been a foreign exchange crisis, and because of my past working with Soros in that realm, I worked a lot with Chinese officials on how to approach the challenge of modernizing their financial markets and integrating with the international markets. And I remember one night at a dinner, they asked me about the process. And I referred back to my engineering education. When I went to MIT, I had intended to be a naval architect. And I said, as far as the world of turbulence in linking up to the rest of the world, you have to prepare your domestic financial markets, not as though you're on board a ship for a cocktail party with a beautiful sunset, but as if you're preparing for a tsunami or a typhoon. The compartmentalization of the ship, so if you run aground or hit a container, it doesn't sink the boat. There are various ways in which the engineering of ship design is very different than what you might call the efficiency of economics. Mervyn, in your previous comment, you spoke about things in addition to climate change. And I remember earlier in this conversation, a reference to Daniel Ellsberg, who also had been at MIT as well as the RAND Corporation, and his most recent book, The Doomsday Machine, is about what you might call that false sensibility or knowledge about the consequences of nuclear war. And it's quite a daunting read and provides another scenario along with climate and pandemic that I think, which you might call, illuminates the danger of some of these false confidences that you've described so well.
And I think a big lesson from that, Rob, is that somehow we've got to try and change the nature of the debate away from it being quasi-religious to being a sort of hard-headed, practical approach to saying we really have to worry about the survival of the human race, about resilience and robustness. There are many threats we should be concerned about. We can't elevate one of them to the status of a religious crusade at the expense of all the others. And over time, what you've seen is that, you know, at one period, the movement against nuclear weapons became more passionate than rational. They're in danger of doing the same thing with climate change. And it's very important that we ask ourselves just, you know, serious, deep questions. What are the practical things that we can actually do? Because what's happening is that a lot of words are written and spoken and said in very strong terms, and yet we look in despair at the lack of very much practical action. And in part, I think it's because of the nature of the debate. It's got to be something in which people aren't on one side or the other of the debate, but they're all in the debate, and we're trying to understand what's the most sensible and pragmatic approach to dealing with these challenges. Because as you said, it isn't just one. There are many of these things that could go badly wrong. And it's very important not to ignore them and put them to one side and focus just on one.
Well, I'm grinning as I listen to you, because one of my forthcoming guests is a gentleman named Eugene McCarraher, who's based in Pennsylvania here in the United States. And his recent book is called The Enchantment of Mammon: How Capitalism Became the Religion of Modernity. And he talks very systematically, a little bit through the pathway of Max Weber, about how the religion of economics replaced traditional religion. And I know you, John, were at Oxford University for some time, and there's a quote that I'm fond of from a man whose name was R.C. Zahner, apparently a controversial man in Middle Eastern politics. But he wrote that the loss of faith in a given religion does not by any means imply the eradication of the religious instinct. It merely means that the instinct, temporarily repressed, will seek an object elsewhere. And I think, Mervyn, what you're saying is very, very powerful, which is at some level, the unmasking of that particular religious strand of how economics has been framed as something that we have to detach from, and perhaps what you referred to as a more pragmatic vision or trajectory becomes now more, more essential, more viable, because the contradictions have been revealed. I know you used an epigraph in your book from Hayek. I prefer true but imperfect knowledge, even if it leaves much indeterminate and unpredictable, to the pretense of exact knowledge that is likely to be false. That was from his Nobel lecture. But I also know there was a great literary figure, and nobody quite knows if he said it, but it's often attributed to him, where Mark Twain said, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." I believe the book that you have written is, how would I say, underscores that the finest thinkers are who they are because they choose the right questions. And though each of you has tremendous dexterity and depth and experience in exploring the question you chose, I think this book at this time is a very, very important offering and a catalyst to that unhinging from a false religion. Any final thoughts?
I think you summed it up excellently, Rob. We'll leave the last word with you.
Well, the last word is a phrase, and it's thank you. Each of you in various meetings in our Global Partners Council, in consultation with me, in being involved in our various conferences, has made an enormous contribution to INET. And I would say today stands right in the front row with those previous contributions. And I just want to express my gratitude and make the future promise that as we turn the corner and continue to learn about this world and its challenges and the role of ideas, that perhaps we could convene again and allow you to illuminate for this audience in another episode. But for today, thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.